The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia, and thank you very much for joining us. I'm Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to be here. Honoré Fanon Jeffers is the author of 5 poetry collections, including The Gospel of Barbecue, Red Clay Suite, and The Age of Phyllis, which was longlisted for the 2020 National Book Award for Poetry and won a 2021 NAACP Image Award. She is critic at large for the Kenyon Review and a professor of English at the University of Oklahoma. An instant New York Times bestseller, her novel, The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois, chronicles the centuries-spanning journey of an American family. Kevin Young is director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture, and also the poetry editor for The New Yorker. He is the author of the poetry collections Brown, Blue Laws, Book of Hours, and Jelly Roll, a finalist for the National Book Award. His nonfiction books include Bunk and The Gray Album, On the Blackness of Blackness, a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. He joins us this evening with his new collection, Stones. Thank you both so much for being here. We're going to welcome Honoré to the screen first, and now the screen is all yours.
Thank you so much for having me. I am just absolutely thrilled to be here with my old friend, old in years, Kevin Young. I've known Kevin for going on 2 decades, and I'm just really honored. I'm going to read from a section of the book I haven't read before, still very early in the book, so these aren't actual spoilers. And this is from a section of the book that's about the parents of the protagonist of the novel, Ailie Pearl Garfield. Her parents are Bale and Jeff. Bale Driscoll and Jeff Garfield, and their quick journey to marriage. There are a few of the regular characters in the book, Uncle Root, who's Bale's great uncle, her father, Jose, her mother, Miss Rose, and her great grandmother, Dear Pearl. Bale's dream told her that she was pregnant before her body told her. She was rocking the most gorgeous brown baby she had ever seen, a little girl whose arms, thighs, and belly were ringed with fat. The little girl looked so much like her own mother that Bale was sure that she belonged to Miss Rose, who appeared in the dream. But when Bale tried to give the baby back to her mother, the little girl screamed. It took Bale time to catch on that the dream baby was inside her. Miss Rose always had tracked her cycle, asking each month, had she seen the moon? There was no morning sickness either, no weight gain, only full breath. By that time, she received her letter that she had been accepted into Columbia's Master of Arts program. Uncle Root had told her that he'd already paid for her tuition, and he located a lady in Harlem who owned a respectable boarding house. Bale had plans for her life, and so she was angry at herself. Another braver girl would be trying to collect money, the $500 that the gossips whispered it would take for a girl to pay a certain Negro doctor in Atlanta who could get rid of a baby. According to those gossips, the doctor was sage and clear, but Bale kept remembering the girl at her high school who had died from a botched abortion. It had been the year that Miss Rose had pulled Bill close, trying to protect her daughter. As cranky as Miss Rose had been, she was a kind woman at her core. More than that, a godly woman who did not believe in speaking ill of the dead. She told Bill that girls should have tried a different home remedy before the pregnancy took hold, like drinking a tea made from wild carrot seeds right after you lay with a man, or ginger root tea, or even the more dangerous poke belly wine, which only the true desperate employed. She told Belle, though, if she ever slipped up with a boy, if the home remedies didn't work, Belle had people. She could come home, and Miss Rose would help her raise the baby. The night Belle told Jeff she was pregnant, she asked if they could drive to their spot. She felt badly for him. He'd be receiving sober tidings instead of the loving she knew he was expecting. In the field, he reached for her eagerly, but she pushed at his chest. "I've got some bad news, Jeff." He leaned back. "Please don't tell me you don't want me anymore, Belle." She touched his face. "It's not that. You're a real nice guy, real nice. This sounds like you're about to break up with me. Will you let me say what I need to, honey? Just wait. Just hold on." When Belle told him that she was pregnant and he began to weep, she knew that she was on her own. She hadn't expected chivalry, but at least some offer of support, a monthly stipend for the baby, something. She was nauseated by the odor of his Old Spice, which only a few weeks ago had driven her crazy with lust. Jeff had told her he loved her. But along with the package of wild carrot seeds and the dry ginger that Miss Rose had given her, her daughter was too forgetful about one and too frightened of the other to use. Miss Rose had told Belle men would say anything to get underneath somebody's dress. And God had made men that way in order to keep the world full. Jeff wiped his face and told her he was sorry. He hadn't meant to break down, but he was just so happy. They were going to have a baby, and then he asked her to marry him. She thought it was a joke, but he grabbed her, kissing her and rubbing her stomach. In a few days, she walked to the faculty building to see her great uncle. She shut the office door, but didn't sit down. "Uncle Brew, I'm gonna tell you something. Please don't be mad." In the roller chair, he twisted his knees back and forth. "Beloved, I could never be angry with you." "I'm expecting a baby, and I won't be going to Columbia. I'm so sorry." "All right. But who might be responsible? And is this situation voluntary?" He extended a surprisingly strong hand. He was a professor at Rutledge College, and his manner was refined, but his relatives knew the truth. If pushed, he could be a very dangerous man. "The boy I went to the former with, and no, sir, he didn't force me."
"That is very good, Maybell Lee. Anything else?"
"Can you go with us to tell the folks? Jeff wants to get married."
"At least he's honorable. I'm sure you're happy about that."
"No, I'm not, but I made my bed."
He snorted. "I guess you did, but I won't ask where you made it."
"Uncle," he told her,
"don't be shocked. He'd once been young. He'd enjoyed that time thoroughly. And she should do the same. Old age was coming faster than she knew. And that weekend, Uncle Root drove the young couple to Chickasetta and stood beside them in her parents' front room. She had made sure Jeff had gone to the bathroom before they left twice, and she forbade him to drink anything before the drive. Belle didn't want him to have to visit her parents' outhouse, not before they got married, because he might change his mind. She had canceled her fiancé not to beat around the blackberry bush either. "Just come on out with the news." Bill made like it was a tradition, a man asking for her hand, but she was scared of her parents and her grandmother. If need be, Bill would put the blame on her fiancé that he had cajoled her to leave her morality aside. She wasn't above saving herself. Mr. and Mrs. Driscoll, I'm so pleased to meet you, Jeff said. And I'm equally happy to meet you as well, Mrs. Collins. Belle's grandmother, dear Pearl, looked at him, then made a farting sound with her mouth. The young man soldiered on. Belle is expecting our first child, so we're getting married Thursday morning at the Chickasetta Courthouse. At those words, Belle's mother, Miss Rose, gave a cry, and dear Pearl stood. She looked with disgust at her granddaughter and the boy who was standing on the rug she braided. When she left, her steps were heavy on the wood floor.
There he is, Belle's father asked.
Yes, sir.
What do you think your name is?
It's Jeffrey Garfield, sir.
All right, then, Jose Driscoll said. But I got me a shotgun to clean in case you change your mind, because I'm not fooling with you about my baby girl.
Uncle Root put out a hand. Come on now, give the young man a chance. The damage was done, but Jeff was trying to do the right thing. Then Uncle Root suggested that the three males in the living room take a walk, see the property and chat a spell. So they did, and they stayed gone for over an hour. When they returned, Jeff looked very pleased with himself, puffed up in some way. But Miss Rose said nothing other to ask the young man, had he eaten? While the men sat on the porch, Belle fetched the bacon grease can, then the skillet to fry the chicken her mother had been marinating in garlic, salt, and onions overnight in the new refrigerator she was so proud of. Some white flour, a spoon and some meal for the cornbread, the bowl of fresh gathered eggs, baking powder, sweet milk, a bit of sugar, butter sliced and melted because her mother didn't make her cornbread with lard. Miss Rose issued instructions and not much else. It was her way when she was furious, keeping her words to a minimum. Her blows were rare, but dangerous when they arrived, and defense was never an option. Stay silent until the storm passed. Her children had learned that was best. The cornbread was out of the oven and cooling on the kitchen table before Miss Rose had her say.
I was so proud. My child was gonna be a school teacher. That was something I could finally talk about after church, because I had one boy on the chain gang and another always running after some fast tail gal. But I guess the Bible was right. Pride go before a fall, because here you come with a big belly. Girl, don't you know anybody can get married and shoot babies out their ass?
Belle reached for a clean cloth to wipe down the already clean table. Nothing she could say would make her mother feel better. And Belle had her own problems. A baby coming and a boy she hadn't planned to marry, but she knew one thing. Soon as this baby came, she'd figure things out, and she still was going to be a college professor. Her life would be larger than this kitchen, that front porch, and even the field out front. She intended more for herself.
I ain't never knowed you to be color struck, though, Miss Rose said. That's why you change your name from Maybelle Lee to Belle. The name I give you ain't good enough.
No, ma'am, that's not it.
That's why you gotta call yourself something else so you could get you a high yellow boy from the city and walk around thinking you better than me. Let me tell you, Maybelle Lee Driscoll, yellow don't mean a thing. Yellow and some change will get you an orange drink down to the dime store. But but the white peoples ain't gonna let you sit at the counter because somebody yellow is still colored. Now you gonna take my grandbaby up north, you and this boy. Lord, have mercy. Miss Rose sat down at the table and sighed, and then stuck a knife into the cornbread. As she cut generous, even slices, she told her daughter, go and get her daddy and them. Food was ready, but be sure to tell Jeff, wash his hands at the pump outside. Just because he was in the country didn't mean he could act any kind of way. That Thursday, Jeff wore a black suit to the courthouse. Belle was dressed in a pink silk chemise purchased by her great uncle, who had brought her a bouquet of white roses, and her father was the first to shake the hand of the groom, who couldn't stop smiling. After the ceremony, there was a big noisy affair that included 6 chickens fried by Miss Rose, a hog barbecued by Belle's daddy, many bowls of potato salad and greens, homemade light bread, various cakes and pies, and unnumbered quart jars of moonshine. After a couple inches of that moonshine, Jeff announced that it was the best wedding reception he'd ever been to, and he sure was glad it was his. Jeff even won her mother over, telling Miss Rose that she definitely knew how to fry some chicken, that it couldn't be beat by any restaurant, not even Pascal's in Atlanta. Miss Rose turned to her daughter and said it looked like Belle had herself a good husband. Make sure she did right by the man. Thank y'all.
Hello, everyone. How are you doing? It's such a pleasure to be here and to read with Honoré. As Honoré mentioned, we've known each other for going on 20 years at least. And, you know, it's been terrific to see the success of this new novel. And always, I've been so moved and amazed by Honoré's versatility, her depth, and her voice. I mean, what a voice. I'm so also pleased to read from my new book. It too thinks about the South. It's a slightly different part of the South. This is Louisiana, mostly, where my family's from, all my family's from. But some parts of the book take place in the North, and we'll sort of start there and head South. The first poem is called Resume, though it's also, someone asked me if it was called Resume, so we might as well think of that too. Resume. Where the trains once rained through town like a river, where the water rose in early summer and froze come winter, where the moon of the outhouse shone its crescent welcome, where the heavens opened and the sun wouldn't quit, past the gully or gulch or holler or ditch I was born, or torn. Drag myself atop this mountain, fueled by flour, buttermilk, grease fires. Where I'm from, women speak in burnt tongues, and somebody's daddy dug a latrine so deep, up from the dark, dank bottom springs a tree. This poem's called Dolor. Dolor. Start here with a dolor that is early September, bringing new weather. The sky a cold color coming on. My son, 1 year older and able among the letters to find his name. I know I am not alone, even if it is my home. Above us, like crows, circle clouds we seek to keep. We sleep long, if not sound, our feet finding morning. Till the end, we sing into the wind. So as you will notice, there's a son in these poems who's quite young and when they're taking place. There's a father who isn't there. And this poem is more about the latter. I am learning how to sleep again, to love the descent, or is it lying here, arising up to summit, where sleep wanders to waking. And when I cannot, when the water leaches into everything and capsizes me, I wonder where you are, Father, if anywhere at all. Excuse me. Does sleep know you? Does day, such nights, dreams fill my waking and worry weathers the dark, the light horribly leaking through the curtains, or awake early, I wait for it to seep in from the east. The land of dead in the west, the hum of sun, none, then suddenly up. It too cannot be sated or slaked off. Brother, sun, mother, moon, father, you cannot find, though somewhere still shines. One thing I was struck when I was writing this poem was the beauty of Louisiana and the country, the two northern and southern Louisiana, those landscapes that are so familiar to me. When I was growing up, my family would say, oh, I'm going home, or we're going home, and that meant Louisiana. And the natural world there, I think, is such a balm. And there's another poem called Balm, which I probably won't read, but it also is how I think the speaker, the self that was me writing these, is negotiating his grief. Egrets. Some say beauty may be the egret in the field who follows after the cows, sensing slaughter. But I believe the soul is neither air nor water, not this winged thing, nor the cattle who moan to make themselves known. Instead, the horses standing almost 15 hands high, like regret, they come most of the time when called. Hungry, the grays eat from your palm, tender toothed, their surprising plum dark tongues flashing quick and rough as a match, striking your hand, your arm, startled into flame. Clearing. It's a strange place to try and find God, inside a building. Better off in a field whose owner, if any, has let the ivy overtake it. Shotgun shacks pulled down, abandoned beneath the green that has no borders and thus is beautiful. Once seen, you won't later in shadow be able to hunt it down. The meadow we sat a while, unbit, shadeless, then went on without. So Stones is also a book about family. And the next few poems think about that. High water is the name of this one. High water. What does the water want? Enters where it is not welcome, jacks up the foundation uneven and splits the wood like a look. It rusts the roof through. Drops by unannounced when your house a mess, rifles through mama's drawers, papers, borrows books for weeks and returns them waterlogged, dogged without no note or knock. Plucks baby pictures out their frames and blurs all the names. Endless, oblivious, it apologizes and blesses and barely says sorry. In a word, you could call it family. Dog tags. Of us, there is always less. The days hammer past, artificial daisies at the grave. Words I didn't choose for my father's headstone and those that came instead to live around his neck. Dog tags. A tin pendulum on my chest. On my mother's side, my cousin, too young, dirt a pile above her, but no stone, nothing but the tin foil name from the funeral home. The fresh plastic flowers that still wilt in this heat. At blackjack, She lost everything. My great aunt and uncle had saved even their low ranch where I first knew blue glass, plastic, covering the rug and the good couch in the sitting room. No one dared sit. The prickly underside of the clear runner, a cactus, you couldn't help but touch. Uncle Wilma's pickup long paid off. Now stairs empty under somebody else's tree. The liars and book cookers came with their knives, offering her seconds. And she sat and ate. Once you've tasted the stone-filled fruit of the underworld, you may never return. They took everything from her, my mother says, both of us shaking our heads, disbelieving how exacting death is, how deep the shade, except breath. She was in debt and dead within a year, went through money like water, and that didn't last long either. Lilies. Almost June, yet the blooms are already done. Here among my grandfather and foremothers, and my father planted too early. We miss you, brother. He will not see another May, whose colors fiery surround us, and now him will not know his grandson and namesake ever since cruel April stole him. Father, never will you know how words blossom for my son this Memorial Day, visiting your stone. Hot, up, more, more, he sings. The lilies we leave will tip over in wind. Near your name, my son doesn't yet know, though it's his own. This one called Sandy Road. I've never read it before, but it tells a story of a slightly different part than my father's. My mother's side of the family in northern Louisiana was in dog tags, for instance, and this is southern Louisiana. It's called Sandy Road, which is a good description, but it's also a name of someone. Shout out to my cousin, Sandy Road. The roads here only lately got names. Before, we lived on rural route blank. The mailbox far enough away across the field, it was worth a trek only once a week to find what the world had to say. Its metal mouth, a garfish few found. No streets, just this rushing stream after a hard rain. Today, the roads remain mostly ditch water and dirt, small stones that migrate, but never far. Today, my auntie complains the roads were named for grandnieces born yesterday who didn't do nothing, instead of after great grandfathers and others who cut their way back here by hand and hatchet, wheelbarrow and know-how, trucking even daylight in. These are our saints, our Emiles and Adams and Banans who made these roads right as rain. We still live in their straightaways and curves, slowly buying back what so-and-so's foolishness fretted away. Once the whole doggone world was young. Once there were no words for things and people had to wait among the grain and listen first, making sure the things themselves, the very stones, would tell you what they wished to be named. Just a few more. This is called Bouquet. Tell the sky, quit stealing you away. Above storm clouds only threaten and will not stay. The sun finds us like fear or family, fills the stomach and asks to borrow you a while. Like sugar, forgets to bring you back. My skin, an orange peeling. There aren't enough words, only these halting, half erased in stone. My wife is resting with Jesus. But just how long? The widower sat here, staring at the hole no dirt can fill, the wound in the ground above his 20-year-old bride, whose stone now tilts and wilts like a bouquet. I cannot say. Let's see. You gotta get in the car, I think. So this is driving. North, it turns out. Squall. Today the sun rained down on us for hours, but for rain shone silver down into the already muddy ground. Each day a squall chases us indoors and sends the dogs beneath the house or dry docked cars for shelter. Tomorrow the mutts will devour my grandmother's birthday flowers. For now, under thunder, they cower. My young son's excited by every boom, says, wow, and claps along as we watch the monsoon from Mama Annie's tiny, tidy rooms. We fill and flood over. Without thought, we draw closer, like the river. All morning, light drowns our hatless heads, till at noon, rain dances down, and we try to beat it out of town. Pack the car and gun it to outstrip the storm now all around. The radio struck silent, and our son. Right after we pass a pickup with mattresses, not lying down or tied, but raised upright, paired in prayer, the beds begin to applaud, to clap together, then fly into the road, now in rear view. Headlights following those just ahead, we nose forward, like fog-bound ships, the lighthouse out, wrapped in white shrouds of rain. Three more, they're pretty short. Speed Trap. This poem is sort of a version of what you might see in a drive like that. Speed Trap. Stray couch wounded beside the road, butts and ribs, next exit, 100%. Virgin hair, Cajun flame-resistant garments, super cool fashions, menswear, 225-925-0000, dad's emissions. Empowering a chosen generation, the table is bread, we buy gold, soul food, seafood, stockyard, cafe, hot, boudin, ivy pride tamales, candlelight dancing girls, armadillos, poor pilgrims splayed along the ditch, Leroy Bar, Best Burger, False River, washing machine in the yard, win $5,000 a week forever. Soda Palooza is back. Welcome to Port Barry Speed Trap, sprayed on FEMA trailers, piled like empty cartons of cigarettes, no shoes, no shirt, no sagging, Best Buy caskets. Please do not flush any down toilet, lake, and the television on my uncle's porch, loud talking no one. Revival nightly. The wind, the empty rocking chair rocks in, wings, 40 cents each. Joy. Once we bathed in joy, ivory once, Mr. Bubbles, if lucky, sometimes accidentally our own pee. Mostly us little ones got soaked and scrubbed like dishes, teeth chipped like our tub. We filled it up. This was back when dirt and each other was all we loved, my cousins and I. How we hated getting clean. It wasn't so much the water or the cold after as it was all that change. The gray circling the drain. Evenings we bathed in palm olive green. Other nights, dawn. And I'll end with this poem called Russet. Thank you so much for listening. And it's been a real honor. And we'll have some questions after. Russet. I want to drink the day down. Maybe next the night. First we'll find our feet the floor. The blue beyond the window returns like a mother after work, collapsing into the living room. I'm home. I'm done being in love with what leaves. Autumn gathers in the trees, russet, then tries not to fall asleep on the cold ground. God, it is hard being happy if you try. Instead, be like this slow yellow. Let go. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. Andre, you can come back too. Welcome back. Thank you both so much for those really, really excellent readings.
Thanks.
Thanks, that was beautiful, Kevin.
Likewise.
I'm going to start. This is a question from our audience. This is from Toby. What beautiful music your writings have. Can you both talk about developing the right voices for your poems? And Kevin, can you also talk about finding a voice in your nonfiction and Honoré, the voices in your novel? Thank you.
Why don't you start?
I would say you were being polite and ladies first, but I think you just saying that because that's
ladies first.
That's a hard question that was just asked. I'm just teasing. I think the voices come to me naturally. You know, sometimes they come to me in dreams. Sometimes they come to me when I'm reading something and I'll start bubbling. And then once I decide, trying to be succinct here, once I decide on what my project is,
right,
then the voices come regularly. But when I'm first starting on a project and I don't really even know that it's a project, it's just sort of a nascent idea, I really, you know, I'm just listening, I'm taking notes. I have a whole bunch of, I think it's pronounced Moleskine notebooks. I found out I was pronouncing it wrong. So that's what I do. I have a whole bunch of notebooks that I have like little, because I, before I started buying the notebooks, I have like a big banker's box with slips of paper from like 1993 and on.
Well, you know, the archivist in me or whatever that is like.
I know, and you know I'm in the archives as well. So I'm like, I should keep this paper.
You got to.
Just in case. So that's what I do. And then in terms of this novel, it took me 11 years to write. So it's a big, you know, chunky baby. You know, it's a big, big chubby baby. And so, you know, I just, it's rich, to say the least. But I don't ever expect to write an 800-page novel again.
Wow. That's
not, you know, something. Kevin?
Oh, well, so, I mean, I think it's a great question. I don't think the process is that different. I would start with the poems as well. And in fact, this book, at the end, I really wanted to put sort of all the datelines of when I worked on it. And I think it starts in 2008, you know, and so you sort of see the time frame. And I think that was important for me, both for the book, but also I suppose for questions like this, because you kind of forget. Yeah, it says 2008, 2009, 2012, May 2014, September 2014, December, and then it goes all the way to quarantine. And that was a rich span of time for me, I suppose. And the voices, I think it was almost like, how do I capture those rich voices? And in that time, I was writing other things, including a big nonfiction book. So in a way, they self-select or they start to gravitate toward each other. It's a bit like planets and sort of navigating that. And how do you understand their gravitational pull? Especially with poems, you know, in a way, you're writing one long poem. And so how do you kind of distinguish between that? I feel like nonfiction, it's a little easier because you have a topic or at least a theme or something you're trying to write about. Mm-hmm. Now, it gets easier to know what the theme might be, but harder to write. And I think that's true of poetry too. And so my first book of nonfiction, The Gray Album, I just didn't know how to write a book like that. And in a way, I look back, I stumbled across some pages of it early on. It had a totally different scheme and, you know, different stuff in it, but there's a kernel in there. And that's the thing you have to find is what's that kernel. And sometimes that's voice related, but a lot of it's structure. Structure really and form. I mean, that governs poetry and these other pieces. And I noticed, you know, Honoré, you know, your use of song is one of those structures. And so to me, it's like, how do you use structure and song and all that? They're all tied together.
Yeah. You know, Kevin and I don't think a lot of people know this. Kevin and I were along with Elizabeth Alexander, the great Elizabeth Alexander, were Lucille Clifton's bonus kids, the three of us. And so Lucille Clifton would always say, Miss Lucille was the judge that picked Kevin's first book for the National Poetry Series. She picked my book for the Stan and Tom Wick Prize poetry books. And Miss Lucille would always say, be open to the word. So I think that, I'm not gonna speak for Kevin, speaking for myself, I'm always focused on one, you know, or two or three particular things, right? Black women, feminism. Now I'm interrogating gender in Black communities, history, settler colonialism, historical transgression, white supremacy. So there are these sort of things that my work sort of gathers around. And so, but I think that takes a while, you know. I'm you know, 54. So it has taken me a long time to be able to say, okay, these are my, these are the themes and the subjects that my work coalesces around. And no matter what genre I'm in, it's still going to coalesce around these sort of things. But you never want to write the same book over and over again, but you do explore some of the same themes over and over. I see that same thing with Kevin. And Kevin's an an archivist. I'm in the archives and have been in the archives for 31 years, something like that. So that, you know, history is always going to be a part of what I do. And I mean, obviously with Kevin, the director. The director of one of the Smithsonian, you know, museums. Obviously, that's gonna be, you know, something he's thinking about. I think I feel pretty safe in saying that.
What else?
Thank you. Okay, this came in very early. Okay. When your books are turned into movies and you're asked to do the screenplay, what would you edit and what would you highlight? Additionally, what would your selection cast look like? Much appreciation.
I think that's for you again.
Okay, that's for me. What would I edit? I'm sure I would edit anything. What I would do is I would probably, I mean, trying not to hurt my little book's feelings, but I would probably chop the book up for parts.
Sure.
So that there would be one movie that would deal with this, or one television series that would deal with this, or whatever, because I don't really think that you can deal with everything. I also think that this is something I'm, you know, working on, you know, if I can do this, you know, as the preachers say, if I can help somebody with an encouraging word, that would be that we learn the nuances of how race has evolved in this country. I am noticing that, and it's not just white readers, it's Black readers, it's, you know, readers across, you know, BIPOC readers, that sure. People have this sort of idea that race is static, or they have this sort of kumbaya, we're all part of the human race, but they don't really understand that how we configure race now is not how we configured. There was no race in the 16th and the 17th century, the early part of the 18th century. So I think that that would have to be something that people kind of walk their way through. Like one of the things I'm noticing is three people have been like, oh, Love Songs is a passing novel. Absolutely not. I reject that. That's an abomination among all tents. But there's this attitude that once you have Black folks crossing other cultures,
and the ensuing issue, those children do not identify as Black, that means they're passing. Because there's this attitude that we're looking at, even if we reject on its face the one drop rule, we're still looking at race as a one drop. And it's not. There's always been these sort of, so I'm not really sure what I would, but I would say this, whatever I could do to get Viola Davis in a movie of this, I love Viola Davis so much. I worship her. She's beautiful. She's perfect in every way. I would love to have Viola Davis be in a movie. I just love
it. Put it out there. I like it. That's good.
So that's it. She's
going to be listening.
I love Viola Davis. I worship her.
Yeah, I saw her on King Henry II on Broadway. And I remember her monologue from that. And just, I was going around telling people, you got to know this person. So I was early in that sense. So.
She's just, you know, She tears up.
What else you got?
All right. Love both of your work. Any advice for people want to start writing?
Woo.
I can try to start. I mean, I think some people tell you different advice. So, you have to, that's probably the first advice, is ask a lot of questions, look around, but you have to find your own way. But I think the first thing is read. You got to read a lot.
Yeah.
So it saves you time in terms of trying to reinvent the wheel. I'm not sure you would make a movie having never seen a movie, but people sometimes think like, a book of poems has its own form. And so you can't just skip over that.
No.
Nonfiction too. The more you read, the more you see what you like, what you don't like. And in a weird way, that kind of dissatisfaction, or that there's a moment I always found, and I used to find this in poems, but I'd be reading books, I'm like, well, they're not exactly talking about the right thing. They got it a little wrong. And then I suddenly realized that dissatisfaction is you wanting to write your own thing. And you have to let yourself have that, but then also not blame everyone else, because you have to write your own, version. I remember trying to get it right. And if you have that itch, let's call it, I think that itch is really important to feed, but also scratch and explore. Mm-hmm. I guess you have to be, and I think this is something Miss Lucille was, she was incredibly brave on the page and in person, but especially on the page. She wrote about things that, were taboo. She wrote about them first. She made them less taboo. She was able to name the thing. And that's really important. You have to be able to go in and make your self known, but also yourself known to yourself. And that doesn't mean you have to write autobiography. But you pick a topic far from you and you bring it close, and the blues taught me that you can also sing in this voice or sing in this persona, but that's a way of channeling your own feelings. And it has to have that heartfeltness, even if it's cloaked in, maybe it was a Chevy and it was really a Ford whatever, but you have to have that kind of feeling that's behind all of it. So, keep writing, write. Read, write, and keep the editor out till as long as you can, but then you have to be ruthless with that editor.
And also remember, I'm a faithful person. I don't try to shove, I'm not a religious person, I'm a faithful person. I don't try to shove faith down anybody's throat. But one of the things that I tell my students is, I don't make you a writer. God made you a writer. Or whoever you believe in. And if you don't believe in anything, then you are what you believe in yourself. But if you were a writer, nobody can stop you. Even bad criticism, you'd be like, they can't stop my flow. You're not going to be able to let it go. And so, but as I also say to my students, and then we'll move on to the next question. I also say to my students, you can't leave your writing and then come back to it and think that it's going to cuddle up to you. It's mm-hmm. like a relationship. You have to devote time and you have to keep it fresh. Ain't no sister getting up making grits and sausage for somebody to show up once every 2 to 3 months. Okay. And so you have to be working, you know, keeping it close to you.
Well said.
Beautiful. All right. This will be our last question for the evening. And I just want to thank both of you so much for your time and for your work. Both of you have an incredible sense of place in your work, not just the South, but specific parts of the South. Might you explain how you remain grounded in these places, even as you live and experience other places?
I'll try to go first. Okay. Give you the last word, of course. What I would say is that for me, you know, sometimes you have to be away in order to see clearly. I think for me, the book, especially, you know, I think the other thing is you can't choose your landscape. It's like your interior landscape as well as your exterior. And so, you know, I've many a time thought, well, that's the poem, that's the elegy. And, you know, I don't need to return, but you always do, both emotionally, but also, you know, quite literally. And it was such a different feeling to go with my young son back to Louisiana where his roots are, and to see these graves, which I, you know, some are, you know, going back almost 200 years, we've been in these patches of land. And so to me, how can you not write about that if you're a writer? How can you not write about that? And in a way, that landscape summons you, it refreshes you, but you also have to leave it in order to return to it. My family's still there in these parts of the world. And, you know, Honoré could speak to this differently, but you know it's a part of you when their accents don't sound like accents to you, you know, and it's just like, oh, I remember people would be like, oh, your dad has such an accent. I was like, what are you talking about, accent? Like, that's just
what are you saying? What do you
mean? And so I think that kind of speech and sound and landscape, all those kind of, I'm going to sound a little woo-woo, but vibrations of that are really crucial to how you write. And, you know, I see it when I close my eyes, and, you know, you got to write about it, but you've also got to be like, you know, I'm in this city far from that and writing about that. But sometimes you have to write about it the day after you're there. Mm-hmm.
I think that Kevin has said so much of what I feel and think about place. I'll also say that, you know, Kevin and I are both descendants from the transatlantic slave trade. And in the South, Louisiana is a little different because it was a French colony, you know, and there was, the, you know, and then the Spanish are crossing, you know. So Catholics tended to keep better records, right? But in the Anglo South, or where the settler colonialists were settler colonizers were Anglo, so much has been erased. So I think that there is a feeling within me, a longing, that will probably never be satisfied to know what that history is. I can only go back to the 1870 census for my mother's people, but my mother's people have been in Central Georgia since 1870. And so I think there's a longing that I have to be able to know. And then with the Native American ancestors, we'll never know. And I think that one of the things that I've learned, just to wrap this up, is whether I will ever be able to prove that I have the blood, the ancestors are still there. Even if you aren't blood kin, you're cultural kin. Because as the great Toni Morrison has said, there's no way that you can have people living close among each other without being influenced by each other. So I think I think there's a grief that I seek to provide a balm for by writing about this, but also a joy. You know, there's nothing like it when you're there, even when I'm in the city in Atlanta, you know, and I'm not in the country where my mother's people, I always want some fish supreme from Decatur, Georgia. You know? Always, you know, I know how the kids act and how they move their bodies and the old cars that they drive, and it's in me. So
I thank you both so much for your time tonight, and thank you to our audience for joining us. Thank you
so much.
Thanks. Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.